Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy any investment based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Hello and welcome to the Sunday Roast. It's Sunday the 8th of December. I'm Phil Carroll.
And I'm Kevin Hornsby. Coming to you all the way from Liverpool.
Liverpool, mate, Liverpool. Another Liverpool. Week closer to Christmas. What's the weather like up in Liverpool?
It seems the big yellow thing in the sky doesn't seem to be making any appearances anyway. Lots of clouds, lots of dull, very windy, and a bit damp.
Well, I'm coming to you from Newbury. I'm looking out. You can probably see the sun on my face. It's actually a rare sort of one of those December crisp days. A bit of rain overnight. That storm Dara came in last night, probably lashing you now as we speak, as you say. But we had rain last night, torrential rain. I don't think I've ever heard rain quite as loud, hammering, you know, when you can hear it pattering against the window.
Yeah.
So that passed. Beautiful, calm day now. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to hopefully let's see if it stays like this for the weekend. But what a busy week we've had, Kev. I mean, I don't know about you, but it's amazing how you spend a couple of days in the city. I've been up there quite a lot recently, but it just burns you out, doesn't it? You know, you're to-ing and fro-ing. Yeah. It's been great, don't get me wrong. It's been fantastic. But obviously, we attended the Resourcing Tomorrow conference, formerly Minds and Money, on Wednesday and Thursday. And it was buzzing with energy. I mean, I think it was far busier than I remember in the past. And we do comment on that later on. And, you know, many companies we spoke to mentioned that they were busy with the back-to-back meetings and sort of manning their booths, barely had time for lunch. Probably guilty of dropping by unannounced ourselves. But, you know, we managed to fit in quite a few meetings and recorded a few sort of impromptu interviews. But what did you make of it for the sins?
Yes, no, I thought things were happening, you know. We've said this too many times, though, that we think, you know, we're on the dawn of something. But all I can say is that all of these resource companies, almost without fault, are moving their projects forward. And yet the share prices have all fallen. I mean, if you look at some of the resource sector, you've got anything from 60, 70, 80, 90% reduction in share prices. Yeah. And they've moved their projects forward. Now, there's probably two things. They were slightly overvalued, or more than slightly, and even though we didn't think so at the time. And now they're massively undervalued. So, yeah. And obviously, we spoke to people from different parts of the world. We spoke with guys from Kazakhstan. We spoke to the guys up in Canada, obviously Ireland, for the Conroy Gold. And we met Marion, who was a breath of fresh air. Her enthusiasm is amazing. And obviously, her knowledge is, I wouldn't say second to none, because I don't know all the other ones, but it was a real eye-opener in terms of...
Yeah, I think it was good. There was more of a pulse. I mean, it was interesting, because Dominic Raab was there on the day we were there. You remember him, he was the ex-deputy prime minister. I think he's now head of global affairs for this Appian capital. And basically, he was giving a sort of talk about the significant challenge of the UK mining sector to de-risk from China and compete globally. But the other interesting one, and I don't know if you noticed it, but there was quite a lot of Saudi Arabians there. The Saudi presence was very high this year.
Yeah.
And apparently their vice minister for mining affairs, a guy called Khalid Saleh Al-Mudaifa, bit of a mouthful, but managed it, announced that the kingdom is surpassing its 2025 mining goals as part of its strategy to diversify away from oil. So very interesting. They're really pushing now for mining. So it'd be interesting to see. And I know we've talked about power metals and all this, the Arabian Shield and all their assets. But I think Saudi is really an up and coming country in terms of investment in the mining space, Kev.
Yeah, not just Saudi, the Middle East. So the Saudi Arabia obviously got the bucks and they want to put it forward. But I think you've also got opportunities in Qatar and in Kuwait and Egypt as well. You know, I mean, big deal done there with the Saqqara mine and for Centamin, obviously, not too long ago. So, yeah, I think there's going to be massive consolidation in the resource sector, to be honest. And the bigger boys are going to have to buy some of these explorers because they haven't got the exploration themselves.
Yeah.
So I can see that this is going to happen.
Yeah. All right. Well, we'll talk more on that later. And obviously, we're going to bring you quite a few interviews from the Resourcing Tomorrow coming up. So listen out for that. But so let's have a look at some of the news stories that have dominated the headlines. I mean, the big one, I don't know, it's sort of sitting, bubbling away. It's been bubbling away for quite a while, is the French government crisis. We saw news that French President Emmanuel Macron is seeking solutions after the Prime Minister Michel Barnier was ousted by Parliament, the first such event in over 6 decades. It was a no-confidence motion backed by both the hard left and far right. So what did you make of that? Do you think France is wobbling? I mean, we've seen quite a lot of unrest in France, protests out on the street, all the issues with the yellow jerseys, the jaunes, gilets jaunes, as they call them. You know, we've seen the farmers protesting against the EU and against all the rights. What do you make of France? It feels like it's bubbling away, and it could be could lead to some further unrest.
Okay, the Republic is under threat, isn't it? It's, yeah. I see France is one of those countries of extremes, isn't it? You have literally got the far left and you've got the far right, and I think my feeling is that those two can't live together. So you're going to have a big problem no matter what. I've never liked Macron, I have to say, as a politician, and just sort of seems to be what he stands for. Don't like his politics. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, we don't like the French anyway, so...
And then you've got Marine Le Pen. She's going through some sort of court case, isn't she, regarding to, you know, use of funds from campaigns and things. So it seems to be like it's a bit like America. That, you know, there's court cases going on. There's all sorts of legal wranglings in the background. You've got the unrest side of things. It does feel like it's
funny though that these court cases always seem to be at the right, don't they?
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
They're aimed at the right. It's like the are the left people perfect people, or is just that they have different ways of going about things to try and do?
And did you see Biden was down in Africa this week in Angola, sort of again on the mining subject. He was visiting a lot of these countries, trying to put things in place and agreements for, you know, try and shore up relationships with Africa and the US, which was fantastic to see. But he pardoned, I believe, his son, didn't he, Hunter Biden, as one
he
of his
did.
Final farewell. What did you make of that? I mean, because obviously Trump was absolutely enraged with this, wasn't he?
Who was enraged?
Trump was enraged. Donald Trump, when he heard the news, he was like, oh, this is, you know.
Yeah, sycophantic. I mean, I don't know, if it was your own son, you'd do the same thing. But I mean, Hunter Biden's is in trouble and is going to be in a lot of trouble. I wonder whether this pardon extends to all the other things that he's possibly up for. I don't know. We will see. But don't know. Keep it in the family.
Yeah. The other one that hit the headlines, and this is quite a bizarre one, was that you saw the news from New York, but United Healthcare CEO Brian Thompson was fatally shot outside the Midtown Manhattan Hotel on December the 4th. The assailant, described as a light-skinned male carrying a distinctive grey backpack, fled towards Central Park on an electric city bike, and the bullet casings found at the scene were inscribed with the words deny, defend and depose, echoing the insurance industry's criticised strategy of delay, deny, defend. This phrase, analysed in Jay Finan's book, criticises insurance companies for rejecting claims to maximise profits. The NYPD is investigating the connection between these inscriptions and the motive behind Thompson's murder. Thompson had reportedly received prior threats, possibly related to coverage issues, and the NYPD is offering a $10,000 reward for information leading to the suspect's capture. So what do you make of that? I mean, it's almost something out of a movie. You couldn't make it up, could you? You know, a guy there apparently waited 24 hours around the area, followed him in the early morning, shot him at first, managed to shot him in the sort of calf by the looks of it from the video, and then he went down and then he unloaded a few rounds. I mean, terrifying scenes, but a lot of people I've seen, it's obviously, you know, social media's lit up, people saying that the United Healthcare are involved in a lawsuit right now with this AI system, which is the one that's been kind of approving or denying the necessary care to elderly patients. Should AI be used in processing insurance claims? There's a whole host of different things to debate here, but what did you make of that?
Yeah, I mean, from a pure loss of life point of view, it's tragic, isn't it? You know, I mean, nobody deserves to die for any reason like this, but quite obviously they've had very cute business practices, let's put it this way. You know, I think there's been books written about this already as well, in terms of the fact that they've literally just put claims. Their first option is to deny the claim, regardless of how, you know, no underwriting, nothing, just deny the claim. So, you know, it's obviously a very frustrated individual who's probably lost somebody they love, and because they haven't paid the claim. The reality is, are insurance companies now insurance companies, or are they trying to be just money-making machines? And I think the reality is we've moved into a time where they are money-making machines, and they don't have the best interest of their clients at heart. It's get the premium in, pay as little out as possible, and otherwise we wouldn't have had this. I mean, I don't think you can say this guy's a madman. I think he's probably heartbroken that these people probably didn't pay
But as you
his
say, it
what.
doesn't give you the right to go and do that. But I can
No,
understand the
I'm not.
emotion. You know, people do these things, don't they? Through. Well, if they're slightly unhinged, you know, it doesn't take much to push them over the edge. But I mean, the public's response to this is very interesting because the company UnitedHealthcare put a post on Facebook basically saying they were deeply saddened by the passing of the CEO, but actually had to take it down at one point because there was about 20 to 30,000 laughing emojis on it. So that shows you that the response to the public and the US, as you say, I mean, when you break it down, the healthcare system there is so unbelievably expensive. You know, we're lucky over here. We have the NHS. All right, it's creaking under the strain. It takes you months and years to be seen. We've got a great private healthcare system, which again is actually not that expensive in comparative. But the US, when you look at them, some people I know were paying almost half of their salaries towards healthcare each month. It's frighteningly expensive.
Yeah, no, it's not even expensive. It's extortionate. I would use the word. I mean, it's gone
Extortion.
to crazy scenarios, and it is. It's the insurance companies, it's the pharmaceutical companies, and the food companies all conspiring together. It's terrible.
I don't know what the answer is out there. I mean, it doesn't seem to be. I mean, they had Obamacare at one point, didn't they? Which I think probably put the Americans into massive amounts of debt, from what I can gather. I mean, some people, I think that's how he won a lot of his votes, isn't it? Because of the Obamacare.
Yeah, but it's sort of medical treatment for all, but at a ridiculous premium.
Yes.
And yeah, America has been systematically destroyed from the inside out in the last 30, 40 years. And I think this Trump presidency is going to lay bare a lot of what the industrial complex has done in the name of profit.
Okay, good. Well, I mean, we've done a bit of the news there. So let's move on. As we alluded to at the top of the show there, we spent a few days at the Resourcing Tomorrow conference in London. So have a listen to we caught up with a few companies and have a listen to what some of the CEOs had to say.
So, Kev, here we are, second year in a row, the Minds and Money Resourcing Tomorrow at the Business Design Centre in London. First impressions this year, it seems a bit more of a buzz, doesn't it? Maybe I think we came on the last day last year, so maybe it wasn't a fair reflection, but here we are on the second day. What are your sort of initial thoughts on it this year?
Yeah, there's a real buzz about the place. I think there's a real buzz about the place. And what I see is that all the companies are advancing their assets, but the market doesn't care.
Yeah,
That's
that's
basically
a
what
good.
the situation is at the minute. You know, is that going to catch up? It has to, almost. It has to. You
Yeah.
know, there's some people we've just spoken with, Central Asian Metals there in Kazakhstan. Very interesting. You know, dividend paying stock. Very reliable resource,
We saw Fulcrum as
copper.
well, didn't we? We saw Aiden at Fulcrum.
Yeah.
It looks like they're focusing on the gold tailings project at Teck Hughes there. And
Yeah. And we saw Mita, who's the PR lady from Power Metals. We're going to try and catch up with Sean if we can. Sean Wade. Yeah. So lots of things happening. Lots of things happening. These companies haven't stopped doing things, you know, they're still doing things,
But
but.
it looks like the market stopped, hasn't it?
Yeah,
Yeah.
market has stopped.
Okay, so we're joined by Gavin Ferrar, Chief Executive Officer of Central Asia Metals. So they're a base metals producer quoted on the AIM market of the London Stock Exchange with a copper operation in Kazakhstan and zinc and lead mine in North Macedonia. Could you just talk us through the assets, please, Gavin?
Sure. The asset in Kazakhstan is not a traditional mine. What we're doing there is reprocessing old waste material that's been dumped on surface by the previous owners of the asset. There's about 650 million tons of waste on surface at a grade of around 0.1%. And all we do there is leach it with what we call raffinate, which is a dilute sulfuric acid. That percolates through, picks up the copper. We then take that solution, that copper-rich solution, put it through what we call an SXEW plant, and produce LME-grade copper cathode. We produce around 13 to 14,000 tons of copper every year.
Okay, and you reported some solid performance across the as you just alluded there, the Kounrad copper recovery plant in Kazakhstan and the Sasa zinc lead mine.
Yeah.
Just talk us through that Sasa zinc lead mine as well in North Macedonia,
sure.
Please.
So we purchased that in 2017. That is a much more traditional mine. That's, you know, we're mining it using underground mining methods, processing the ore into what we call a flotation concentrate, which is then sold to smelters for conversion into metal. We're producing around 21 to 23,000 tons of zinc and 27 to 29,000 tons of lead metal. From that operation. It's got a life out to 2039 on the current resource and reserve base. We look to extend that every year, being an underground sort of narrow vein operation. That's quite sort of common for those things to extend well beyond the resource life there. So we've just invested around $40 million in that asset, which will future-proof it in terms of resource extraction and also from a tailings deposition methodology.
But the main revenue driver is obviously the copper then in Kazakhstan, and that, would that be fair to say?
No, actually the revenue is probably split 50-50 between the two operations, depending on the commodity prices, of course.
Yes.
Profit-wise, because we don't do any mining and rehandling of the material, you're right, the Kounrad operation is more profitable. The EBITDA margin there on a standalone basis around 72% versus about 37% last year at Sasa. So it is a more profitable operation, but as I say, revenues, but generally 50-50.
And how do you see the copper price going? I mean, how geared are you for an increase in the copper price in terms of both your share price and the revenue and the EBITDA that you would
generate? Well, I mean, operational leverage is probably quite low because we, you know, at 14,000 tons, as I say, which is not a huge amount of copper production in the global sort of scheme of things. But, you know, obviously we benefit from a much higher copper price anyway, and we have also low cost. So, you know, again, the leverage is probably not as great as would be for a high cost producer, but the profit, sort of incremental profits that we make in a high copper price environment are very important.
Yeah. And what is the mine length, even though it's not a mine, what is the length of
it's a good question.
Resources available?
Truly a finite resource because it's sitting on surface.
Yeah.
The current license actually expires in 2034, but we believe that it's possible to produce copper well beyond that, because we will be leaching copper, you know, up until 2034, and then we'd look at a license extension to take it future, but it would be at a lower rate of production.
And what was the actual percentage of copper that is in the material?
In the waste material, the average grade is 0.1%.
Okay, which is very low,
very
isn't
low,
it?
Yeah,
really,
yeah.
It really
so,
is.
Yeah.
But it's obviously very cost effective to leach it out.
Super cost effective. Look, it's a unique asset. There's a few elements to it which make it unique. One is an impermeable layer that it's been dumped on, so we don't need to lift it up and put it down on a lined base. Second is there's naturally occurring bacteria within these dumps that are breaking down a lot of the mineral species into copper species that are leachable. And I guess third is just a, you know, super low cost of operation.
Yeah, Kazakhstan's a cheap place to do business.
The big input is the electricity cost, and Kazakhstan is like, you know, a very cheap producer of electricity.
Okay, very good. Well, maybe we will have to have a much more in-depth interview with you at some point in the future and dig deep into these two projects and see whether people find you an appealing investment.
No, look, it's great to have the opportunity just to introduce the business, so thanks for that, and I'm very happy to spend more time with you in the future.
Thanks a lot.
So here we are, we're joined by Marion Moroney, Non-Executive Director, and John Sherman, Chairman of Conroy Gold and Natural Resources. Marion is a recognized and accomplished leader in the exploration and mining industry with over 30 years experience in exploration, mining, strategic planning, governance, identifying new business opportunities, joint venture management and oversight and mergers and acquisitions. A hell of an introduction there, Marion. So welcome.
Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. So obviously here we are with Conroy Gold. Just talk us through what sort of first piqued your interest with Conroy.
Yeah, I first met the management team at PDAC about 6 or so years ago. When they asked me to swing by the booth and have a look at the project, I kept in contact each year with the team during PDAC most of the time. And then last year, I left the company I'd been with for many years. And then at the beginning of this year, on my way to PDAC, Maureen reached out and asked if I'd like to come and look at the project on the way. So I stopped in Ireland, went up to the site, met the geological team and the rest of the management team, and importantly, had a look at the rocks and the mineralization style. And really what I observed was quite striking similarities in terms of the geology, so the host rocks, the age of the rocks, the type of rocks, and also the style of mineralization that we see in southeastern Australia. I grew up mostly in southeastern Australia and I studied at Melbourne University, and so I understand these types of ore bodies pretty well. I also worked on them 20 plus years ago when looking for opportunities. And so I really, really liked what I saw, but what I particularly liked was that it wasn't just a single isolated deposit, it's actually a proper district. And it's an emerging district that's been, what I call, it's been prospected. It's had surface sampling and a few holes drilled into a bunch of the anomalies, the surface anomalies. At the most advanced project, Clontibret, there's clearly multiple styles of mineralization and overprinting mineralization. So that indicates you've had multiple pulses of ore-forming fluids coming through. And that's quite attractive if you're looking for economic ore deposits. And so we can see what Clontibret is at the moment. It's a 500,000 ounce, 2 gram ore body. But when you look at what the deposits in Victoria have grown to be, you know, these are 5 and 10 million ounce type deposits. So I think there's a huge growth opportunity on the project once we understand more fully the controls to mineralization.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for those words. I mean, we've obviously visited the core sheds in the past, in Ireland. And one thing is, I saw the announcement there was a new presentation, the Discs of Gold project, where it looks like the company is now refocusing on looking at the assays and basically reanalyzing the historical assays. But how instrumental were you in sort of advising the company and saying, yes, we need to look at these and we need to focus on these particular assays?
Yep, I think I was pretty instrumental. So, you know, geology always comes first. If you don't have that right geology and the foundations correct, it doesn't matter what you build on top of that. When we looked at the Clontibret project, you can see that it's, you know, quote unquote, open in all directions. But what we don't know is which direction should we be going. And the only way we can establish that is by re-logging the holes and updating the data sets with modern techniques and modern tools in a more uniform way and a consistent way, so then we can actually build a coherent geology model to then go from, as I said, prospecting to actually highlighting, here is the control, here is where the high grades go, I can clearly show you this, and here is the next drill target.
Yeah, it's. I mean, we've walked down those muddy fields in Clontibret down into the lake. I mean, the interesting thing with what's happening in China as well is the antinomy as well. What have you any thoughts on that in terms of how it will affect the gold? You know, does the antinomy come because of the gold or vice versa?
Yep, great question. So let me just take one step back. So in southeastern Australia, we have Fosterville, which starts at shallow levels being gold, antimony, arsenopyrite, and then transitions to gold, antimony, and then ultimately really, really, really high-grade gold at depth. And by high-grade, I'm talking 2 ounces per tonne. So really company makers. In addition to Fosterville, there's also a deposit called Costerfield, just to the east, which is an antimony mine that has some gold. So you have the, what I'd call the spectrum of gold, antimony, antimony, gold, and parts in between. At Clontibret, we definitely see that there's veins, thin veins that have antimony and gold. But there's also a broad structure, 100 metre wide, that grades consistently a gram that is not necessarily associated with the antimony. We also see in the parallel trend to the east, the Skull Martin trend, a free gold where we've got intersecting vein sets. So there is definitely multiple styles of mineralization. Mm. The antimony was not included in the previous economic studies and really hasn't been looked at since the old antimony mine of, you know.
Well, when we were splashing in that stream, they were talking about the Canadians that come over to look at the antimony and then thought about the gold as well.
Yep. So as part of upgrading the model, the geology, one of the areas we'll obviously be focused on is the antimony. Because is this an antimony gold mine or a gold antimony mine, or is it both? And we just don't know. So, and the final aspect is that the antimony hasn't been included in the project economics, the previous studies, which will be superseded with this new work. And, you know, I'm optimistic and confident they'll improve. But bringing in that antimony will definitely improve the economics.
Yeah. And do you see from this multiple pulse situation, do you see that Clontibret and Clay Lake is a whole system, as in they could be connected, or is it just likely to be too?
No, I'm almost positive they're connected. So at Clontibret, I said we have the 100-metre wide structure that has a stockwork zone consistently grading a gram per tonne gold. When we go to Clay Lake to the north, we also see a 100-plus-metre wide structure that's grading 0.6 to a gram. Mm. So that main structure definitely continues. Between those two prospects, which are, 8 kilometres or so apart, there's very, very, very little drilling.
Yes.
And so this is this concept of actually putting the geology together to then help target. Those structures are actually part of those structures that extend further southwest across the Atlantic and then into eastern Canada. It's that same structural corridor. So they're significant deep tapping structures.
Okay, very interesting. So you've been enjoying yourself basically making pictures of what is about. I'm glad somebody understands that anyway. But I mean, Clontibret, the land that is owned by Conroy Gold, how big and how deep, if it was a Fosterville, would that go?
Well, Fosterville, the really, really, really high grades, those 2 ounces per tonne start at 800 metres below surface. Mm. The majority of the Clontibret drilling is, give or take 150 metres on average. So there's a lot of space to look at between 150 and plus 800 metres. The thing with, say, Fosterville is you don't just go and drill directly underneath where the previous drilling has been done and where the old open pits were. You have to follow those high-grade controls, and they're actually extending away from the old open pits. So that's why it's super important we understand what those controls are to the higher grades, so then we can target them, because they won't necessarily just be vertically down.
Yeah, you need to know where the pulses have come from, and obviously in terms of the stream. Okay, very good. We must talk to you in more detail, because obviously we've only got a few minutes here.
Yep.
Another time, because it's fascinating. John, what would you like to add? Don't give us any geological stuff, by the way, after that.
No, I mean, having met Marianne on board has been super helpful, charged up the team. And I think they enjoy having someone of her geological smarts to bounce ideas off of and help guide the work. So it's really put us in a position where we can focus our effort more and prioritize bringing in the mine at Clontibret. We have the land package, but now we need to get the ounces out. And her contribution means, when we do our next drilling, it's targeted and with purpose, and ultimately to upgrade the resource and add ounces to
it. We should maybe get Mariam to write down what she thinks it's going to be before it comes up, because that mightn't be a bad idea. But I love your enthusiasm, Mariam. It's fantastic. So it's infectious.
Probably slipped down to William Hill.
Yeah. Don't slip down to William Hill. Just go and buy some Conroy shares.
Very good. Well, John Sherman and Mariam Moroney, thanks very much for your time.
Okay. Yeah. We're excited to have Greg Marta, Executive Chairman of Capital Metals, joining us for a short interview. Welcome, Greg.
Yeah. Good to meet you guys.
Absolutely, yeah. So just talk us through it's a bit of a vibe in here, really. I mean, we came last year, Kev and I, and it was pretty quiet, but we're getting more of a kind of a bit of a buzz about the place. So just to talk us through your experience of mining the money.
Yeah, I think that's because they've reduced the cost of the panels.
Is it? That's it, is it? Right.
It could be a sign of the market, right?
Right, we'll have to get onto Kelvin, Kev, and make sure he upgrades the booths.
Yeah. Is like microscope.
Yeah, don't try and push anything on it. You'll go straight through and you'll become an iron ore miner next door.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. Love it. So, well, what are your thoughts on it anyways? Is this your first time here?
I've been in the industry a long time, and I haven't been to Mines and Money for probably 10 years. But, it's an interesting time. There's pretty depressed markets, and everyone's sort of clutching at straws a bit. I haven't seen any big checks being written, but we're not asking for checks. We're not looking for equity.
Yeah, absolutely. So can you just talk us through this Mineral Sands project, this Eastern Minerals project? And I know you had an announcement at the beginning of the week where you announced that there'd been a significant reduction in the CapEx, bringing it down to one-third decrease from the 2022 PAS. So just talk the listeners through exactly what that means for the project going forward.
Yeah, sure. So our project is one of the highest grade projects in the world. And, in the mining industry, you'll know grade is king. And in our case, it truly is king. It's a standout in terms of grade. So what we're all about now is a race to cash flow. Like a lot of companies in the space, the development timelines are getting longer and longer. And we've just said, right, we're going to cut through it. Let's look at the cheapest path to get into the first stage of production. So our 2022 PEA, it had a total capex over four stages of 81 million. The first stage was about 30 million. We've looked at what we can cut back, spoken to the off-takers, certain things we don't need, such as we don't need a washing plant because we can use salt water, revise the flow sheet a little bit. So we've got down to 20 million. We're pretty sure we've identified areas where we can cut that down even further. We're going to buy an off-the-shelf plant, which is exactly like that one up there. That's our biggest piece of kit from Mineral Technologies in Australia. That's 3.2 million Aussie, and that's our biggest piece of kit. Very simple gravity, and it'll end up being a very high margin operation in the first stage, payback of less than 12 months.
So just talk us through some of the challenges, because obviously when we think Capital Metals, we remember there was the incident in 2022 where effectively you lost the mining license. Just talk us through how things have changed and how you were brought on board, your background, and you managed to get the license back effectively. So just talk us through the background on that.
Yeah, that was a hell of a period. My background's in resources, investment banking with Morgan Grenfell and Deutsche Bank. And then I ran the international business development for a company called Normandy Mining, which we initially bought all the assets off the French government. So right through Africa, right through the Americas. You know, I've seen some exotic jurisdictions. And, you know, Sri Lanka, that's an exotic jurisdiction, but I have not seen as blatant an attempt at corruption as what this was. This was the environment minister, which the mines department is part of his portfolio, literally tried to steal the asset by cancelling our licences. He had the company, it was an Indian shelf company, that he wanted to issue the license to. So we kicked his ass, literally. We took out international arbitration, local litigation, massive lobbying. The IMF were in there with a rescue package for Sri Lanka because it went broke because of former corrupt politicians and it suffered during COVID. So we got the licenses back. And then we rebuilt the relationship with the mines department, the new ministry, the new, you know, the BO, the Board of Investment, all those guys. So we were ticking through the boxes. But it's been a journey to get it back there.
Yeah, thanks. And Greg, you were then saying you got approached by an Australian company?
So we had, right through even the while the licenses were cancelled, we were in discussions with two companies, one called LB Group. LB Group is a Chinese listed company, about a 5 billion group that is. They're the largest pigment producer in the world, so they were pretty keen to get a hold of the offtake. And also Sheffield Resources, which was the developer and now producer in Australia. And we ran that to the wire, and then we end up choosing Sheffield. And a lot of that to do is with the LB Group, the founder of it, the old man died, and the daughter has sort of taken over the reins. So their heads were spinning a little bit. So we chose Sheffield, and we got right to the wire in July of this year. And unfortunately, they started to have some commissioning issues in Thunderbird, their only asset. And so they had to keep their cash to be able to fund the issues they were having.
Do you like going on very high-speed roller coasters?
Does it sound like it?
It sounds like it.
Well, you know, I was brought in at the bottom, right? and I carried it up the top of the hill.
I think you've done a few loop-to-loops there
And I've just dropped to the... So I've only done one jump. So
no, but I think you went up and over as well. When he stole the licenses, that was outrageous.
It was outrageous.
Outrageous.
It was great to have a win. It was a really good win. I mean, this guy got so exposed publicly on television.
Yeah.
I'd like to see him go to jail.
I was going to say that he didn't go to jail.
No, but it's not over yet.
Okay.
There's just been a new election in Sri Lanka, and this young guy, Anura, has got in at the NPP, and he just won two-thirds of the vote.
So, wow.
And he started off with three ministers out of 225. He's now got 159. So he's got a clean slate. He was all about anti-corruption, getting rid of the government largesse. So he's cleaning the place up.
So going forward, that should be very good. I mean, before we start to record this, you were telling me about the finances based on moving forward. I mean, it's some goal to have £20 million capex, and you're talking about paying this back within a year.
Yeah.
Is this really practical? Because we see so many companies say, oh, it'll only take this long, but...
Well, you know, that is... What we're targeting is the final investment decision in Q2 of next year, and it's $20 million US, not pounds, so...
Yep.
You know, it's a smaller
smaller. You could change it to Australian dollars and there'd be even less.
Well, you know what? I think we won't be that far off that target.
Okay. Don't say that. You're not allowed to say that.
I think we can. And the ASX, we couldn't. Yeah, look, I think it's eminently achievable. It's such a simple operation, particularly this first stage, the concentrate. But yeah, as we've all heard it, promises and what we're going to deliver. Yeah. But we're trying to keep it as simple as possible.
Yeah. And if you do deliver that, then it's going to be cutty cooker from there. You're going to sort of 550,000 tons per annum, add another unit to that, becomes 1,100 units, then another unit to that, 1.65, and then maybe over 2 million tons. Obviously, the resource at the minute is 17 million. How confident are you that that's going to be increased looking at the sands and the area that you've got?
So to put that into perspective, the resource was done in 2016. We haven't added to it at all. And we haven't been doing any more drilling, partly because we had those issues with the license.
Yeah, so you were on a roller coaster. It's very difficult to drill when you're on a roller coaster.
So the resource only goes to an average of 1.6 meters. We did a little bit of drilling in 2018, which there were holes down to 16 meters, finishing in mineralization. There's one hole of 14 meters at 28%. So we're very confident that with the drilling, the rig's about to go back in the next couple of weeks. And that'll be a two-month campaign. It's very cheap. It's air core drilling. The budget's 90,000 for that. So
you think it could go further down, but you've also got longer to go along inland, the coast as well.
Yeah, that's right. Inland, there's areas still to be tested. So there's two purposes of the drilling. One is to at least double the resource out of this campaign. And the other is to just get greater certainty for that initial mining area so we can firm up our mine plan.
And you're hoping to go for one of the higher grade areas initially?
Yes. Yeah.
So that the payoff can be quicker, I presume?
Yeah, it's reasonably homogeneous over the deposit. You know, the average grade, we're quite confident, is going to be 20%. Again, put it in perspective, our cutoff grade is 5%, which is higher than the global average of mineral sands deposits. Our geo says that we could reduce that cutoff to 2%. That'll double our resource straight away. It'll reduce the average grade a little bit, but it'll still be a standout. So
yeah.
So there's this is going to be a lot longer than a 10-year mine life.
Yeah. Anyway, this is only going to be a short interview, so there is a lot more to talk about here. I think there's a lot more to investigate. Even the fact that you've got a note out saying that your MPV share price should be around 36p, and you're just over 2p at the minute. So. Bit of a discrepancy in the market, to say the least, but that's not unusual in the market. So people want to hear the story in depth. Yeah, and I'm sure you can tell us some very interesting Sri Lankan stories while you were on that roller coaster.
Indeed.
We look forward to that because it will be entertaining.
Thanks very much, guys.
Yep, thanks, Greg.
Let's have a look at some of the movers and shakers of the week. The best mover of the week at the time of recording was Sealand Capital. They were up some 450% on the week. I know of no reason for the share price rise, and it appears neither does the company, because they issued the usual RNS stating they note the share price movement and know of no reason for the increase. I mean, it's amazing how some of these stocks can do. 450-500%
What was the market cap before it moved 450%? Because these were the guys that had retail stuff in China, didn't they? They had
so the market cap is currently 10.5 million. So it would have been, if it's 4x, it would have been around 2.5, something like that.
Yeah. Somebody knows something, otherwise they wouldn't be going up 450%.
Yeah, they're a social media and technology company focused on consolidating compelling opportunities in the global marketplace. So whatever that means. Yeah. But interesting. They talked about AI applications and outcomes. But yeah, as I say, they did issue the usual share price movement RNS on Wednesday of this week. But
and potentially next week down 550%.
Absolutely.
Or down 50-60%, sorry.
Yeah. The other one that moved well was Brand Architects Group, who were up some 95%. They moved for a reason on the fact that the Warpaint London announced an agreement to acquire Brand Architects Group at around the 48 pence mark, and they were trading around 46 pence on the Friday there. So yeah, I mean, acquisitions are happening in the market, obviously. quite a good uplift in that, circa 100% uplift in the share price from where they were prior to the announcement. So that was good. Yeah, Greatland Gold, they settled around the sort of just above the 7 pence, around 7.2, 7.3 trading on Friday. They announced in the week that they'd completed the transformational acquisition of Newmont's 70% interest in the Havieron Gold Copper Project and full ownership of the Telfer Gold Copper Mine and related assets in the Paterson region for up to $475 million. This deal consolidates ownership, enabling an integrated Telfer Havieron mining operation, and Telfer, with significant ore stockpiles, is expected to generate near-term cash flow to support Havieron's development, projected to be a long-life, low-cost gold-copper asset. The acquisition includes deferred payments tied to future production milestones and gold prices, with Newmont now holding 20.4% of the Greatland shares, and Greatland plans to dual list on the ASX by mid-2025, solidifying its position as a significant Australian gold-copper producer. So great to see that one. We said it would happen hopefully by the end of the year. It has done, so fair play to Sean on that one.
Yeah, I can see Sean smiling like a Cheshire cat, I would imagine. Yeah, he set fair, I think, for big revenues to come in, and though he didn't really like to say it, I really think there's a very, very strong possibility that they're going to be able to finance Havieron without too much more debt from Telfer. And they've got the know-how there to expand Telfer's life mine, I think, or line up mine life to, who knows, 3 years, 4 years, 5 years, 6 years, 7 years, 8 years, 9 years, 10 years. Who knows? And the whole region there is going to be able to use the Telfer processing, and it will give Greatland a great advantage to help other explorers in that region to achieve their aims, I think. So, yeah, I can see that. I can see not necessarily motoring, but, you know, I don't know about yourself, I can see it creeping up to 8, 9, 10p over the next
I think it would be nice to see it move up even by the end of the year. I think we said maybe 8p, didn't we, that it could quite easily move up to, in, you know, now that the acquisition's done. I think that the next steps are obviously first ore, or first processing, sort of some cash coming in from those tailings from the sites there, and actually getting some revenues coming in from those stockpiled ores. So very interesting times at Greatland. Great company. Celadon obviously had an announcement on Friday. They announced that effectively they'd received the remaining 150,000 from the third admission of shares at £1.05, as announced in May 2024. James Short expressed gratitude to shareholders for their support and thanked employees for advancing the group's intellectual property, enhancing harvest yields, and maintaining its role in the UK's pharmaceutical cannabis market. So when do you think the market's going to wake up to the value of Celadon, Kev?
I don't know, but I hope it's soon. I mean, 18p, and somebody just put in at 105. And I know they in inverted commas, were
honoring it
and obliged to do it because they'd gone into that raise. But it's way overdone, absolutely way overdone. I mean, you've been to the facility. I've been to the facility.
Yeah,
they've got the ability to have revenues in the 20s of millions next year, and market cap of, I don't know, I think it's about 15 million or something or less. It doesn't really add up, but what does add up at the minute? Not a lot.
Okay, yeah, I mean, it's an interesting one. But the other one that was a bit more of a shaker this week, that they announced on Friday, some pretty negative news. We've seen quite a few companies do this, was SDX Energy, the Moroccan-based energy play. They announced plans to cancel admission on AIM, re-register as a private limited company, and adopt new articles of association. So usual thing, you know, that the high costs of maintaining a public listing, limited share liquidity, market volatility, and greater funding options as a private entity doesn't bode well when you see RNSs like this, really, does it, for the whole of AIM? Well, not just AIM, but the small cap space.
I think AIM must have lost about 10% of its listings this year. I mean, I don't know the facts. We probably need to look into that. But I can't blame them. You can't blame them. I mean, I think it's Morocco and Egypt. I don't know whether they got rid of the Egypt assets.
I think there are some assets in Egypt. You're right. I was looking for that then, but certainly Morocco-based.
And I mean, I don't know what share price it's trading at the minute because I haven't looked at it. But I remember owning that share at 30, 40p.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's currently 0.85p, and even on open on Friday, it dropped 55-60% on open. So, I mean, as soon as they announce that, then people obviously run for the doors because they want to try and get at least some capital out. But, I mean, it's an interesting one because the market cap was, say, you know, if it dropped 60%, I don't know, say 5 or 10 million or whatever it was, or 8 million pounds. As a private company, that, you know, just by announcing that they're going to be a private company, potentially, they've dropped the market cap valuation down to £2 million. You know what I mean? It's
But the reality of the thing is that they did say in the RNS that they would then put a sort of barter exchange system in place for people to trade the shares.
Yeah, match trading.
So I think what you're going to find is that the valuation of that company off market will probably be significantly higher than it is now. But just on a revenue basis, you know, the in Morocco they're being able to sell the gas at a premium. And, you know, I don't know the full details about the company. This is more my historical knowledge of it from 3 or 4 years ago. But, yeah, it's a sad indictment, really, in terms of the market. And, I mean, there are people still coming on to AIM because we were at the Priority AI offices on Thursday morning. And they're raising the money now and about to list in the next couple of weeks. And it was fascinating, really, to be honest, to speak to some of the employees, speak to Dan Gee as well, who's going to be the managing director. The number of ways that they're going to be able to turn the AI into revenue streams was incredibly encouraging for me.
Yeah.
Openly admit we are shareholders in this company. And but it was very, very interesting, all the different ways. In a very basic way, turning the AI model and using it to produce revenues, whether that be in hospitality, whether it be in advertising, whether it be in using social media for the companies that are signing up. We saw Energy Pathways have signed up with those guys because you were at the party or whatever the Ben had produced. They had a deal also with Flavella, is it?
Flavella Beers.
The beer on the basis that those guys may want to list in the future. So there'll be then the opportunity to maybe to help raise money for those guys. And then that will obviously be part of a revenue stream for Priority AI. So I see really good things ahead for that. And that was really encouraging. Maybe this is the new type of company that needs to come on board to literally revolutionize some of the way business is done in terms of that. So, yeah.
The other event happened this week, which was a historical moment, was Bitcoin obviously achieved a significant milestone. It surpassed the $100,000 mark, and it briefly touched $104,000 for the first time, largely attributed to the pro-cryptocurrency stance of the US president, obviously-elect Donald Trump, who plans to nominate Paul Atkins, who's a known crypto advocate, as the head of Securities and Exchange Commission, which is just absolutely bizarre. Nomination is expected to create a more favorable regulatory environment for digital assets, boosting investor confidence. So we probably didn't think we'd see it. Well, it was coming, but I don't think anybody expected it to happen this year. Obviously been boosted by the whole likes of Musk and as I say, this new appointment. You and I, we saw a great post I shared with you about the Dutch tulip mania in the 17th century and the sort of contemporary rise of Bitcoin that the comparisons have been made. Slightly different, but it's all down to the rapid price escalations and speculative nature. What did you make of the rise above 100,000, Kev?
So before the election, we were talking about Bitcoin at around 70,000. It's topped 100,000 now. I think it's come off a bit. I think it's finished it on Friday. It was trading below 100,000, I think, because obviously a few people have then said, I'll have some of that profit. So 18 months ago, Bitcoin was 20,000 and you couldn't give them away and nobody loved it. And here we are 18 months later, we've topped 100,000. We've five bagged. If it works like any other security, it seems to be that then there'll be a big sell-off. Whether 100,000 is the mark where that sell-off starts to occur, we don't know. But big sell-off down to maybe 40,000, 50,000 again, and then there'll be another bull run. I don't know whether that will happen this time or not.
Yeah, it'd be interesting. I mean, some of the people are predicting $1 million in the next 5 years, which would be interesting. I mean, I'm never say never, but it's a very, very interesting one. But that Dutch tulip mania was crazy, wasn't it? I mean, do you know the reason why it sort of, or one of the reasons why it drove the price, this crazy mania about it?
I presume it was just because there was limited stock and people were searching for...
No, so what happened was that there was a mutation which was caused by a virus, which was known as the tulip breaking virus, and it created these unique and highly sought-after colour patterns and the petals. There was loads of streaks and flames of different colours. So they were sort of labelled as a bit, it was like almost witchcraft at the time. And these broken tulips were obviously very rare and people were just going mad for them because they were so striking. And then obviously what happened is then prices skyrocketed as people were trying, you know, oh, I've got one of the rare ones. I've got one of these, you know, the striking, or they call them the Semper Augustus bulbs. And they started trading them. And then it got to the point where I think that they were trading one bulb was trading for the equivalent of a mansion house in Holland, which is, crazy times. And then all of a sudden, they just dropped. There was an auction on, and no one bid for one bulb, and it just absolutely crucified the price, and they dropped down. But interesting, very interesting story, that one. What else, Kev? I mean, you alluded to there, you talked football. We went to the Emirates Stadium. First, I've been there before, but what were your impressions of the Emirates Stadium?
The stadium itself was superb. And it was extremely well done. You know, when I can compare it to the likes of Anfield, where you don't have the same modern way of doing things, or modern stadium, I should say, then... Amazing. Atmosphere was good. If I compare it to Anfield, and I'll get some haters from this, not as good as Anfield, I'm sorry. Just further away from the pitch, you know, it's just not as wonderful in terms of the atmosphere, in terms of my view.
You had a better view than me, because I showed you my view, and I was literally four rows from behind the in the north stand, effectively behind the goals. And I struggle with the whole depth perception. When I'm watching a game, I like to watch it as the view you get from the TV. You can almost see them from a side profile running. You can check the distances and offside. When you watch it from behind the goal, you have, unless you're watching the team attacking you know your goal, you can't see that when it was down, you know, the away end or the away end from me, it's impossible to see where the ball is. And you know what I mean? Like, in terms of perception. So I found that really view. There's no way I could watch it. I actually went in at half time and watched from the screens in where the bar is and everything, and enjoyed it in the warmth and there. Cause I had the wind and rain whipping in Kev because I was on row four, and it was like sideways vertical in my face. But great atmosphere, as you say, really, really good atmosphere, but probably not as good. I mean, I've been to obviously Old Trafford a few times. I think it's great. I'm saying, one thing that did strike me is people do not sit down. Did you notice that? I don't know where you were, but where I was.
No, it was because we were in the North Bank, and the North Bank doesn't sit down. I mean, that's sort of the old terraces, if you like, from Highbury. So I think it was more to do with where we had the tickets than anything else, was my thoughts anyway. But
and then everyone was checking the phones, weren't they, for the Liverpool score, mate? I mean,
yeah, they were more interested in the bloody Liverpool score, and there's me sitting there chatting full with the Arsenal supporters all around me, pretending like I was just there to watch the football, like no concept of whether it be Arsenal or anybody else. So, you know, there's me halfway through the first half, I think it was, said to the guy, who scored for Newcastle, you know, I was asking the question subtly, and or trying to ask them subtly, and then it went 1-1, and then they were all like, and then it went 2-1 to Newcastle, and they were all like, shouting to the players, Liverpool are losing, I was thinking, are you coming here to support Arsenal, or are you here to support Liverpool, or not support Liverpool, I should say. And then
they got the win, Kev. And the main thing is they wanted you to drop points. It was you'd be the same, man. You know what I mean?
No, absolutely. No, I think we would. We would be following it. But there's definitely at 9 points or 11 points, they really think it's
seven now, up. Though, isn't it? Seven points now.
Yeah, even at 9 points, there's no way in my mind we're winning the league. Like, we're not walking away with it. No chance. I mean, we could. For sure, we're favourites to win it now. We must be. Yeah. But it's not a foregone conclusion by anybody's stretch. Because this season, amongst all of the seasons, it looks like there is a lot of competition, you know? I'm looking at the Chelsea match, and
Chelsea are struggle.
I mean, and then Spurs last night got beat by Bournemouth as well.
Well, Spurs haven't got a mission as far as I'm concerned. They're never going to win it, and they're not even going to be top four. I don't think. I think the top four that are the top four now are probably going to be the top four, which is Liverpool, Chelsea, Arsenal, Manchester City.
Yeah.
And I think those four will start to pull away, and then it really will be a competition, in my view, of when they play each other. When those four teams play each other, it's going to be interesting. Now, Liverpool have played Arsenal, Chelsea and Man City already in the first round. I don't know who hasn't played each other in terms of Arsenal, Chelsea and Manchester City in the first sort of group of matches. But I think that could decide it, to take points off each other. But yeah, great experience, even though it was a miserable night.
Miserable night in London.
But very, very good experience. So thank you, James, for organising the tickets. James Sheehan organised the tickets for us. And unfortunately, we weren't all together. So he was in one part being an Arsenal fan and the rest of us were in other parts. And we met his three brothers, didn't we, who were all Arsenal fans. So, yeah, it was great.
Okay, so Jaguar, what did, obviously they Jaguar has been, we talked about them in the past. There's been a lot of debate about this. I mean, you've got to hand it to Jaguar if all they have done is got some brand awareness out there with this woke advert that they put out initially, which we talked about. I think everybody's talking about it. It's been discussed on Radio 4 breakfast show. It's been discussed pretty much everywhere or social media. They unveiled this week the Type 00, which is a bold electric vehicle concept. And I'll stress the word concept because it certainly looks like a concept as part of the rebranding strategy. The Type 00, which was showcased in vibrant colours like Miami Pink and London Blue, represents Jaguar's shift towards an all-electric lineup by 2026. The design, featuring a distinctive bonnet and sleek LED lighting, has sparked mixed reactions. Some praise its innovation, while others criticise it as a woke Tesla. Jaguar's leadership defends this direction, emphasising a commitment to creativity and relevance in a changing industry. The Type 00 aims to attract a younger demographic, with plans for production models to follow in 2026. So, I don't know if you saw the car. It looks pretty much like a Rolls-Royce Spectre to me, or Sceptre. So they say copy nothing. It looks like a pretty much almost like a direct copy of the existing Rolls-Royce model. What do you think? Do you think they've got a market now? Do you think they've actually done the rebrand successfully?
Well, think about it. Here we are on a podcast talking about them.
Exactly.
Right? So if the marketing point was to make Jaguar into the conversation to attract whoever, then it's been mega successful because it's been on the news channels, it's been everywhere, okay?
Yeah.
So from that perspective, it's worked. My concept of the car, would I have bought a Jaguar before? No. Would I buy a Jaguar now? No. But it's not me that they're aiming at, is it? It's a group of individuals who want something maybe a bit outlandish, a bit different, you know? Maybe they think it's, inverted commas, iconic. I don't know. It just looked like a... obviously, to me, it looked like a... an electric car of the future or of a movie, you know, maybe that's what they're after.
I mean, when you look at it, it's got an extremely long bonnet and I cannot see the actual production car having, I mean, it's got like visions of the E-Type and there's, you know, people are not going to want to drive a vehicle that's got a 3 meter long bonnet that's poking out into the traffic where you know what I mean? Like pulling out of junctions. If you've ever driven an original E-Type, they're almost impossible to maneuver from junctions. They're not easy. And there's no way they're going to put something out with such a long bonnet. So I think it's interesting. It's bold. Yes, it's aimed at a new demographic, maybe younger people trying to get pull people over from Tesla into something a bit more kind of aspirational. Let's hope that they sell in droves because I would hate to see the brand, you know, fall away. It's difficult. As we said last week, it's very difficult in the automotive industry now with the guidance and rules and fines and tariffs and fares and punishment, you know, it being put out.
If you think about the electric cars and what we were talking about a couple of years ago now, do you see the same motivation for people to buy electric cars that were there, you know, 2 years ago and we're all moving to electric cars and that's the way it's going to go and da 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 da? I don't see it.
Well, the next car I'm going to buy is going to be, I'm going to go full electric, but just as a sort of city car, just to use for short journeys. And it's going to be either a Renault 5, which is the reimagination of the old Renault 5. It's fully EV. It's got about 250 mile range, 300 mile range. I've actually put a deposit on the Alpine, which is a sportier version of the Renault 5, the A290, which is a small four-seat hatchback. I think 280-300 mile range, and it's going to be perfect. It's going to be cheap to run. I'm not going to be pushing it up the motorways, doing 300-500 mile round trips. It's going to be used locally, and I think as you said last time, for a small city car or around town, perfect, absolutely perfect.
But I have to say to you, you're buying that car also out of nostalgia because you like the Renault 5 turbos or whatever they were called. You know, that was a boy racer car of your time. So, I mean, for sure they're going to be driven. I still reiterate, it's going to be very urban style cars in my view. You know, and if you're going to live in a third world nation where ultimately the infrastructure just isn't there to charge your car, never mind anything else, you know, they're not going to take them on. For decades. I don't care what anyone says. It'll be decades. And even in the West, you know, they're saying, you have to do this, you have to do that. Well, if the infrastructure's not there, you're not going to be able to do it.
Okay, and one final thing. Some great series coming. Obviously, we always get around autumn, winter. We get a great TV. And there's a new series on at the moment. And I urge people, anyone who's into sort of like spy-type James Bond things. Obviously, I mentioned the Day of the Jackal, which has been reimagined. That was fantastic. New episode landed this week. It's coming up to the finale. But the new series is that has to be watched. I saw the first episode last night, and I'm hooked already. It's called Black Doves with Keira Knightley. Ben Whishaw stars as well. You've got Sarah Lancashire in there, the great Northern actress who was in Happy Valley. It's a British spy thriller that premiered on Netflix, as I say, this week. A festive backdrop in London, great scenery, some fantastic scenes. And I'm not going to spoil it too much, but there's great character development. So anyone who likes a sort of spy stuff, check out Black Doves on Netflix. You will not be disappointed. Anything else, Kev, what are you up to at the weekend?
Well, I'm in Liverpool here, so just spend some time with the family, catching up and getting some Christmas presents to take back with me. I had ordered a whole load of stuff, as you know I do sometimes, so when I got here, I already
It's funny watching you in London pulling this big hold all behind you, getting it jammed in the underground, and people push it, kick it, kick it. It's like, Kev's here, he's come with all his clothes on, and he's got a massive hold all for all his...
And there's nothing in the bag at all, except for another bag.
Yeah.
And I arrived on Thursday evening, and to my catering size bottle of mango chutney, which I will take back with me, and a 3 kilogram bag of Haribo jelly babies because the kids love those. And I've got to get my beans sorted out, my Heinz beans, and my tomato soup, Heinz tomato soup, all those things that aren't particularly good for you, but you just miss them. I've got masala cream supposed to be coming with Amazon order today. So, yeah, all those things you don't get here, which you take for granted. And, yeah, I'll also try and take some bacon back and some... I like the dim sum that I can get here, the shumai. Can't really get it the same way in Egypt, so I like to take that back as well. So, I'm going to have full bags when I go back.
Full bags. Yeah, good stuff. Well... On that note, obviously, if you like what you heard, please do subscribe. Hit the bell icon so you get any future notifications of any further episodes. And thanks for listening. Have a great weekend, all.
Yep, thanks for listening, guys. Speak to you soon.
This podcast was brought to you by Roast PR Limited. If you would like to appear on a future episode of The Sunday Roast, please email admin@thesundayroast.net.